Okay, so let's get started. Couple of announcements. Next class would be midterm, as we all agreed upon, and it'll be a closed book and notes, but you can get a sheet of paper with, handwritten notes. Typing and having, special glasses that can read 0.4 font is not good. And really, I think there should not be more than about one sheet worth of material that you need to be reminded of. The rest should be just understanding. Okay. And then you can, I guess, in some places, obviously, you might be doing multiplications and additions, and you can get a calculator if you prefer. Okay. The other thing is that I have to start the exam right at the beginning of the class and end it right at the end, because we have things both, before the class and after the class. And so make sure that you show up at 4:30 and be here, because if you come late, then you lose time. Normally, the exam tends to be longer than the time that you have for it, for most of you. So you don't want to lose time. Okay. And then, so today I myself am going to discuss clustering, which is not on the midterm. So that doesn't necessarily mean you should just fall asleep right away. We will come back to it again next Thursday, right after the midterm, so the continuation of this. Are there any additional questions on anything? Yes. You can bring scientific calculator. Doesn't matter. Anything else? That's it? Calculator is the best question you have on the exam? Okay, so fine. I will be, if you have questions, send me mail, depending on, either I or Sushovan would get back to you. You still have, I think, 5 days, so there's enough time to prepare. Okay. What I am going to do today is continue discussing clustering, which I have already explained why we're looking at clustering in this class. Now I'll just go back to the classical clustering. Okay. Assume that we are interested in clustering things, clustering text documents. But really, to understand the algorithms, you might as well think in terms of points in some Euclidean space. Okay, so our vectors in Euclidean space. So essentially, suppose you have two-dimensional vectors in this particular case, and here are these vectors. So the question is, do you see clusters here? Okay, how many clusters do you see? Okay, why two? Why not? Why not? These guys can, make a little cluster by themselves, those guys can make a different cluster, et cetera. So it's not obvious, first of all. I think most of us probably see two clusters, but it's, the issue really is you can find as many clusters as you want, actually. In fact, one of the issues that we'll talk about is how many clusters are there for, these many points. And it turns out it's a humongously large number. Okay? It's a combinatorial number because there are many, many different ways of clustering them. Even if I assume that I am looking for two clusters, okay, even if I'm assuming that I'm looking for two clusters, there still is a question of, who goes into which cluster. So we'll look at this little later, but essentially, if you are looking for k clusters and you have n documents, you essentially have that many different cluster rings. Now, you will actually be looking for k equal to 1 all the way to n clusters. Okay? K equal to 1, it's kumbaya, everybody is together, just one cluster. K equal to n is the happiest kind of clustering where you don't have to have roommates. It's just you live your life and you don't need to talk to anybody. It's the psychopath's dream come true. Okay, so you just sum this, that's the number of clusterings you have essentially. Okay, so the question, in fact, as we look at this kind of a picture is, first of all, how would I come up with a clustering, first of all, and even if I came up with a clustering, how do I know it's a good clustering or a bad clustering? Okay, and then, so in some sense, just as in the case of relevance, in the case of deciding whether a document is relevant or not, we first discussed how would you know, if you came up with some IR system, how would you evaluate it? Is it good or, you know, better or worse than your friend's IR system? And so we talked about precision and recall. So pretty much the first thing we'll do today is talk about how would you evaluate a clustering if you came up with one. Okay? And then talk about how to come up with clusterings. Okay? But anyway, so, you know, if you look at something like, you know, looking at the general points about the clustering, one very important issue in the beginning itself is, are you looking for hard clusters or soft clusters? Hard clusters means you can only belong to one group. You cannot have fractional memberships between groups. Okay, this obviously is hard clustering. Soft clustering, you know, it's much, much more different. Okay, in fact, there are infinite number of soft clusterings because you can have, you know, slightly differing memberships between just two clusters. You can be 0.9 of this cluster, 0.1 of that cluster, 0.901 of this cluster, and the rest from the other cluster. And so each of them would be a different clustering. Okay? So you can talk about, well, are you looking for hard or soft clusters? We will mostly, unless I say, tell you otherwise, we'll be looking at hard clusterings. Okay? The biggest thing in clustering is, and we already talked about cluster quality, and we'll talk a little bit about it in a minute, but the biggest thing in actually looking for clusters is the notion of distance. Okay? Presumably you thought this is a cluster and this is a cluster because in some sense these guys are close to each other, these guys are close to each other, and this cluster as a whole is somehow far from this cluster as a whole. Okay, this close, far, these are all notions of distance. Okay, so to understand clustering, you need to understand distance. Now, of course, there are multiple ways, and distance is connected to similarity. Distance is proportional to 1 over similarity. Right? So, in fact, when I say distance, I mean similarity too. Okay, so if you are using text documents, then you would be considering the similarity measures, the whole set of similarity measures we looked at, you know, vector similarity, Jeccard similarity, any of them can be used. Okay? So the question, of course, is based on the way you define the distance, you will look at a different clustering. Okay? And so for text, of course, you will be looking at cosine versus Jeccard. The other thing, in terms of, if I give you a clustering, so the distinction that I'm using, the wording that I'm using is clustering is, you know, saying that this is one cluster, between them they cover the data. That's a clustering of the data. This clustering contains one cluster here, another cluster here. So that's the, you know, usage we'll talk about. And, you know, this was computing the number of clusterings, right? Okay, so what we'll discuss now is how do we talk about quality of a cluster, quality of a clustering. Okay, now in general, actually, clustering has been called unsupervised learning. The idea is nobody told you how many clusters are there. Okay, you're just looking at the data and looking for patterns to say, okay, maybe there are 4 clusters here, maybe there are 3 clusters here, and these are those clusters. Okay, so clustering is actually unsupervised learning because you're not told beforehand how many clusters are there, how many types of elements are there. If I, for example, told you, okay, here are all the documents, some of these are, you know, mails from my office, some of these are mails from my family, some of these are mails from my students. Can you cluster them? That's not normal clustering. That's essentially a classification problem. Because I've already told you that there are 3 classes of mails. Okay, the classical clustering problem is I give you all my mails and say, cluster it any which way you want. And then if your clustering is good, then I'd be happy. Okay, so it's called unsupervised because you're not supposed to know anything more. But you know, we'll see as we go on that oftentimes you also get additional information. So for example, and I'll keep on talking about this example today to make you happy, which is a classic clustering I do at the end of each semester. It's a one-dimensional clustering. I take your cumulative marks and put clusters around and then say this is A, this is B, this is C, this is D. Okay? And I do that clustering. Okay? And so the question then is does anybody actually know how many people are supposed to get A's and how many people are supposed to get B's and how many people are supposed to get C's? No. Okay? I can make you feel falsely happy by saying anything above 90 is A. And you know, students tend to feel better about it. Anything above 90 is A, anything above 80 is B. But I am setting the exam. Right? It doesn't make any difference whether it is above 90 or below 90. Ultimately, I have to still look at the marks, look, and then somehow decide the clustering. Okay. Now, the one good thing is while I don't know who should be getting A's and B's, I do have some additional information, right, in that particular problem. For example, it would not be nice if I were to give somebody with a lower cumulative mark A and a higher cumulative mark B, because there is some sort of a, you know, ordering between the clusters in that case. And secondly, the other good thing is the number of clusters is predetermined. You know, I always, as I told you, I would have liked to give n different grades where n equal to the number of students here. Okay? And so each person gets their grade, which is their cumulative mark, and that way I don't have to waste my time after the cumulative marks has been, you know, developed. That's it. Okay? But everybody wants some sort of a equivalence classing, saying these are all together in one cluster, these are all together in another cluster. Okay? So grades clustering is a clustering, except it's not completely unsupervised because at least I'm told that you only get to give these 5 or 7 different grades. And that there is also inter-cluster relationships. Okay? The point, of course, is that if I give you a clustering and if I really have no other information, then I have to just look at the clustering by itself and see, does it look nice? Does it look nice, round, and shiny, essentially? That's all you can say. So those are the internal clustering measures. So the internal clustering is, God knows, I mean, who knows what actually are the actual clusters that I'm supposed to find in this data? Nobody knows. But I will find you nice spheres. And you would be happy, I would be happy. Okay? That's internal measure. So internal measures of clustering depends on two issues. One is called intra-cluster tightness. How tight is the cluster that you found? Okay? And inter-cluster separation. Okay? So the goodness of an internal clustering, the internal measure of goodness of a clustering is based on these two numbers. And of course, how to define them. That's what we'll look at next. Now, once in a while, you might actually have gold standard. Somebody actually told you that I happen to know, you know, among these mails, there are only 3 classes of mails. You know, one is from my office, one is from my home, one is from my students. Okay? And I just let you cluster it. You came up with maybe 3 clusters, maybe 8 clusters. But I know that there are only 3 different kinds of mails. I know which mail is of what kind. So I can then externally evaluate your clustering and say, oh, look, you know, you seem to have taken my office mails and split it into 3 different clusters. Or I can say, look, you have made a cluster which seems to have half my student mails and half my, you know, family mails. Why did you do that? Okay, that's an external measure of evaluation of clustering. Okay, so we look at both of these. Most of the time this is not available. Most of the time you're only going with this. You know, you're just looking to see whether or not your cluster rings have nice internal properties. And clusterings with internal properties may have no connection to external properties. Okay? Yes.
So if you go with the mindset of finding only different number of clusters, then you're not going with an open mind, right?
I know, I mean, but just the question is, many a time you happen to be looking for some number of clusters. In fact, the very first algorithm we'll find, you know, k-means clustering, works with the assumption that k is given upfront. Okay? So the basic point, of course, is that it is a hard problem. You know, you do not know how many clusters are there. And you do not know, even if I tell you how many clusters are there, where to, you know, draw the boundaries for the clusters. Okay? Okay. So the clusters can be evaluated in terms of internal measures and then external measures. Okay? So I'll look at first the internal measures. In the case of internal measures, you talk about intra-cluster distance and inter-cluster distance. Okay? So that's what we'll look at first. Okay, so here is the intra-cluster distance or tightness of a cluster. Now, what does that depend on? It depends on the distance between points in the cluster. Now, it turns out even that is not very easy to define. There are multiple ways of defining it. This whole slide is to say that there can be a spectrum of internal measures of goodness of clustering. So, if your clustering is not good with respect to one measure, and you're losing with respect to your friend's clustering, then you change your measure and say, I'm better with respect to this other measure. Okay? So, and it all depends on, for example, so in the case of intra-cluster, that is within the cluster, you might be looking for the distances between all pairs of points. You might be looking for the diameter of the cluster, which is how far are the two farthest elements in the cluster. Okay? Or you might be looking at the average distance between every point and the centroid of the cluster. There are three different ways of defining tightness of the cluster. Okay? Now, when I have multiple distances, so for example, if you have all pairs, if I'm taking the distances between all pairs of points, I can talk about the average distance between all pairs of points or the max distance between all pairs of points. It so happens that if I take max distance between all pairs of points, that would be the diameter in that case, right? Max distance between all pairs of points is the diameter of the cluster because those would be the pair of points that are the farthest from each other. Okay? And you can also define the tightness in terms of how close are they to the centroid. So you then consider the distance between every point and the centroid. And when I'm saying distance right now, it's okay for you to think in terms of Euclidean distance. But remember that I can change the distance to be vector similarity. I can change the distance to be something completely different. Okay? So I can do that with respect to the centroid or the pairs of points. And when I have pairs of points, I can talk about the sum of the distances or the average distance or the max distance. So that's what this is saying. Sum, min, max, average of either the absolute distance or the squared distance. Again, that's the other thing. Do you want to take the absolute distance or the squared distance? Normally, you know, you just assume absolute distance. Okay, between pairs of points or the pairs of two farthest points or between the centroid and the points. Okay, all of these are ways of computing tightness, some measure of tightness of a cluster. Okay, now comes the intercluster distance. In the case of intercluster distance, there is this other problem, which is what is the distance between two clusters? Okay. Once again, so here I have a cluster. So if I go back here, here's a cluster. What's the distance between them? I can talk about the distance between the two closest points. I can talk about the distance between the two farthest points. I can talk about the distance between the two centroids. All three are fair. In different applications, each of them makes sense. Okay? So if you're taking distance between centroids, that's normal idea. If you take distance between the two farthest pair of points, it is a name for it. It's called the complete link clustering. There's just, you know, for historical reasons, they call it complete link clustering. Okay, that means you're taking distance between the two farthest pairs of points. Okay, one point from this cluster, one point from this cluster, such that they are the farthest. Okay, distance between the closest pair of points in the two clusters is how close the clusters ever come to each other. and that would be the single link clustering. And in fact, depending on which one you wind up taking, you might wind up getting different kinds of clustering. So for example, it shouldn't be hard for you to realize that if you were to use single link clustering, you are likely to get chain-shaped clusters, the way people cross red lights in Arizona. Because the guy in front of me crossed, so I should be able to cross. The guy behind me thinks that guy is crossing, so I should also be able to cross. So nobody has to actually stop. So the whole train of cars will, you know, go over. So it's a cluster of a chain of cars just, you know, goes over because they're only saying, hey, I'm close enough to that other guy who just crossed, so I should be allowed to cross too. And, you know, just in case you are feeling particularly smug about Arizona drivers and thinking I wouldn't do any such thing, you do it all the time in asking for changes in your letter grades. When, you know, at the end of the semester, you know, if by mistake I tell you the entire cumulative grades and how the grading was, you know, how the clusters were made, then you will come to the teacher's office and say, how can you not put me in the A grade? You know, I'm so close. Right? You know, I'm only 47.5, the lowest A grade is 48, so why can't I be in the A grade? Okay? You would never say, why don't you push me away because the guy above and the A is 100 and I shouldn't even be allowed to pass this class. You would never say that. You would never say that. Right? You would never use complete link when you are asking for grades. The teachers, on the other hand, are looking at the complete link. They're saying, how can I, in good conscience, put this bozo, and this person in the same cluster? Right? You, on the other hand, want better grades. So you say, you know, you allowed him in to go into A grade, which is the other side of the red light. So why can't I, too, go in? Okay? So again, I think they're reasonable. I mean, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing. It's, you are optimizing your objective function. And your objective function is to get better GPA, and this is the way to tell, okay? So my point is that if you ever forget about what is complete link and single link, you know, remember grading analogy. Complete link is what the teachers probably are looking at, either complete link or centroidal distance between clusters is what the teachers are looking at, and the single link is what you would be looking for. Okay, how do I argue my way into the next cluster? Okay, fine. So the point again in this slide is that there are multiple ways of defining. So the multiple ways of defining the goodness of a clustering. The goodness of a clustering is some function of the intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance, where the function can be, you know, sum or, you know, something else. Okay, and then each of the components can be defined in multiple different ways. Intra-cluster tightness can be defined in different ways. Inter-cluster distance can be defined in different ways. And the way you define it actually winds up having an effect on the kinds of clusters you will find. Okay, if you are looking, if you are basically defining single link as the distance between clusters, then you will actually find chain-shaped clusters. If you do complete link, you will find more spherical clusters. Okay. Actually, we'll look at this example a little later, but think about this example. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 points. That's it. Okay. There are two clusterings, the red clustering and the black clustering. Can you see that picture and see which one would be produced by complete link clustering and which one would be produced by single link clustering? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So who would produce the single link? If you're maximizing the distance between the farthest elements, okay, which one do you get? And if you are maximizing the distance between the closest elements, what?
taken care of.
So anyway, I guess I gave you the answer, but you know, think about that. Okay, so that's basically, you know, in that case you can see two clusterings, and you know, the two different clusterings come from the two different ways of defining cluster distances. That is the point. Okay. The next thing that I want to discuss is external evaluation. So this is what you normally are stuck with. You don't expect to get anything more than looking at your clusters and seeing are they nice and shiny. That's it. Okay. But when you actually start making decisions using these clusters, the big bad world might say, no, you're completely wrong. And you will only find this, you know, over a period of time. Okay, but sometimes you might actually have gold standard. You know, upfront, as I said in my mail example, I might have told you what is the kinds of mails I have. So in fact, here is my example where, let's say, the red points are, let's say, office mails, the green points are the family mails, and the blue points are the student mails, let's say. I have told you this. You are trying to do the clustering, okay? And you did not know, while you are clustering, you did not know the labels. Because if you do know the labels while you're doing clustering, then you don't need to do clustering. You say whatever you said, you know, and then be done with it. Okay, so I let you do the clustering and you came up with these three clusters. Okay, which is normally, in this case actually, at least it so happened that there are three clusters and there are three classes. But that's also not required. When you came up with the clustering, you might come up with two clusters, are one cluster, are 25 clusters, even though there are only three classes. Okay, but so let's look at this. So there are three classes, and it also happens that there are three clusters. In this case, basically, I have external evaluation because I've been told what the classes are to begin with. So then I don't care as much about how nice and shiny each of the clusters are. Are they circular? Are they far enough from each cluster? That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in seeing whether each cluster is sort of purely accepting one class. Okay, one idea we'll look at is the purity of clusters. So suppose the purity of clusters means this is almost a red cluster. So in the best clustering, it should have been just red clusters. The blue one should have gone to its own home. And this would be almost a blue cluster. So that blue guy should have come here, actually. And the red guy here should have gone there, right? And then finally, this one is almost a green cluster. Now, how do I decide this is almost a red cluster? I basically looked at the max class of the cluster. Okay? So, and then, so the pure size of a cluster, each cluster, is the number of elements from the majority class. Okay, so for this, it would be 5 because there are 5 red ones. For this, it will be again, it's 4 because there are 4 blue ones, and here it is 3 because there are 3 green ones. Okay? And then I will then define purity of clustering, a measure, as the sum of the pure sizes of the clusters divided by the total number of elements across all clusters. And had you done it in such a way that all blues were here and all greens were here and all reds were here, then essentially this would have been 1 by 1, which would be 1. I mean, the same number by the same number. So the total number of elements by the same total number of elements, that would be 1. So that would be the best purity. Anything else will be less than 1. Okay? So this is a way of computing. So if you came up with a clustering and your friend came up with a clustering, you can compute this purity measure and say who is better. Okay, in this particular case, actually, the clustering's purity is 0.71, and you can check this once you go home. The real question is this general enough? And also, first of all, you know, there is one more question we'll talk about in a minute, but, you know, one obvious question here is, if you came up with two clusters, and your friend came up with 17 clusters, who wins? 17 clusters always win, right? Because if you put every element in its own cluster, that cluster is pure by definition, right? Isolationism and psychopathy have their advantages, as we talked about, okay? So basically, the problem is that, in fact, you'll see this a little later too, but in general, if you increase the number of clusters, you can just increase the purity by increasing the number of clusters. So if you came up with two clusters, your friend came up with three clusters, this won't compare well across the different clustering sizes. This is a pretty good measure for computing across the same number of clustering. So this is a good measure for me to actually suppose, you know, like Michael Crow or somebody in ASU have figured out the inherent A-worthiness of each of the students. Okay, and then they're trying to test me to see whether or not I'm finding the true A, B, C students. Okay, since there are only so many grades, A, B, C, D, E, I presume, okay, then essentially the number of clusters is the same, and so number of classes, so, you know, if I came up with one clustering and a different teacher came up with a different clustering, they can compare to see whose is a purer clustering with respect to the true labels. Yes.
So this can compare with recall versus precision.
In a minute we will do that, but yes, yes. Actually the next one will be even better connection, but these have connections to purity. The purity has connections to precision, for example. Okay, but then the next version which we'll look at, which is more general, actually takes both precision and recall into account, both false positives and false negatives into account. Okay, but that's a very good point. One thing, so in general, this idea won't work if your number of clusters increases. There are ways, there are other methods for comparing clusterings of different sizes, okay, which sort of take into account, you know, sort of have to have a penalty factor for the number of clusters, okay, but I won't look at that right now. Okay, the second idea is, in this particular case, in some sense, there's a problem with this measure, which is, in essence, you're saying that 17 clusters would give you perfect clustering, a perfect measure, right? It just, you know, if anybody tells you that they're going to be doing purity-based check on your clusters, you just put every, you know, element in its own cluster, and you'll be done with it that way, okay? So there's something wrong, inherently wrong about purity-based clusters, unless you also give the number of clusters. You know, it seems almost like you can just always go to the total number, you know, each element in its own cluster, and you'll get purity one, which is like in a short circuiting it. Yes.
So it's going to be, we find the sum of the pure sizes of the clusters,
mm-hmm.
and to find the pure sizes, we need to define the classes very clearly. And
yeah.
If we have the classes, then why are we doing clusters?
No, but that was my whole point. I mean, I think, I'm sorry, I mean, again, my whole point was that this is stuff that I happen to know, and I'm testing you. I'm testing your clustering after the fact. In real world, external evaluation of clusters is an oxymoron. Do you see what I'm saying? In real world, you don't know what the classes are.
I was trying to understand if we can directly use this funda in the net.
Yeah, but the point is, if you happen to know, in some cases, if you happen to know what are the classes, then you may be able to do external evaluation. Okay, but then it would not make it into a more of a multi-class classification problem than a clustering problem. Okay, we'll get to classification in a minute, in like a couple of classes anyway. But in general, so the, you know, in classical machine learning, you differentiate this binary differentiation between unsupervised and supervised. But the reality is it's a spectrum. Okay, more and more supervised you go towards classification, less and less supervised you go towards clustering. Okay, and so there are actually ideas like semi-supervised learning, for example, okay, and our semi-supervised clustering, for example, all of which basically kind of bridge that gap. But we are talking about clustering 101 almost, okay. So anyway, so these classes were only available after the fact. So for example, the precision and recall studies can only be done if somebody actually knows what the relevance is after the fact. They can only be done after the fact. You know, somebody who happens to know what is relevant for them can look at your results and say, this is the this is relevant, this is not relevant. If you happen to know already what is relevant and what is not relevant to the user, then why waste your time, you know, going through vector similarity and page rank? Just use that information directly. Okay? So, as I said, the problem with this is that, you know, if ultimately you are saying that it's actually a reasonable idea to put everybody in their own cluster, that sort of makes no sense. So another way of looking at it is, what actually are we doing when we're doing clustering? We are trying to put friends together and enemies apart. That's another way of thinking of clustering. Okay, now the concept of friendness doesn't apply to single individuals, ignoring narcissism. Okay, so the point is that to even talk about friends, you have to talk about pairs of people, pairs of elements. Okay, so the reality is you shouldn't be thinking about the elements, you should be thinking about pairs of elements. And for every pair of elements, you want to see if it was a friend. That means I'll assume that all reds are friends, all blues are friends, all greens are friends. Okay? My question then is, am I doing my level best in keeping all the friends together and keeping all the enemies separate? So not only are the reds friends, blues friends, greens friends, reds and blues can't get along, blues and greens can't get along, greens and reds can't get along. So if you put a pair which is enemies in the same cluster, you have lost a point in some sense. If you put a pair which is a friend across two different clusters, then you basically separated friends, and so you'll lose a point again there. Okay, if you look at it that way, then of course the number of pairs, if you're looking at number of pairs, then there are n choose two pairs. If there are n elements, there are n choose two pairs. Okay, and for all those pairs, I can split them into these four classes. Okay, so on top, it's basically, are they in the same cluster according to the clustering? That means, are they under the same circle? Or are they in different clusters according to the clustering? And then this one is saying, are they of the same color? That means, are they supposed to be friends according to the ground truth? Or are they supposed to be enemies according to the ground truth? Okay, so if you are in the same clustering and you are supposed to be in the same clustering, that's the true positive. In some sense, that's a true positive. Okay, and if you are in different clusterings and you are supposed to be enemies anyway, then it's true negatives. You're supposed to keep them separate. Just a second. Okay, and then the other two are false positives and false negatives. Okay, and then what I will do is I will count the I'll have a measure called RAND index, which is basically TP plus TN by the total number of pairs. Yes, there was a question. Which one? These columns. This is, they are supposed to be, if this is asking, are you in the same clustering? Are you in the same cluster in the clustering that the user came up with? Okay? And this one is saying, are you supposed to be in the same cluster? That's, again, that this whole thing, we're going back and forth on this. This is external validation. After you came up with the clustering, okay, so the idea is, you came up with the clustering. When you came up with the clustering, all these points had the same color, gray. Because you have no idea who is supposed to be together, who is supposed to be farther. You actually believed that you selected them in such a way that these are all supposed to be together, these are all supposed to be together, these are all supposed to be together. That's what your best bet is. And I, the oracle, have come and told you, well, actually the colors of these are all, these are red, this is blue, these are blue, this is green and red, that's red, red and green. This is after you were done. So now I get to, check how well you did in the exam. So presumably when you're writing your midterm answers, you write the best answers you think you can write. And then I look at the answers that I have and then compare them and give you grade. It's external validation. Okay? If you already know what are the answers I have, then you shouldn't think. You should just copy them. Right? Okay, so the whole idea is you don't know that. So external validation occurs, after the fact. And what I'm saying is that in general, actually, in clustering, you may never have external validation. You may never have external validation. For the longest time, we have essentially have decided certain groups of people have certain kinds of characteristics. Okay, so remember, HIV was called what? GIS or something, gay related disease. Why? Because they were trying to do clustering. They were trying to look at all the people who have AIDS, all the people who didn't have AIDS, and came up with the smart idea that these seem to be homosexuals, these were not. Okay? Anything that is actually not conforming to the hypothesis, we'll call it experimental error. And then come up with a name. And we live with it for a long time. Okay? We live with it for a long time. If in fact the president of some country happened to know the true answer, they could have come and told you, you know, hit you on the head and say, hey, you know, you made a mistake. Your clustering is wrong. The clustering should be a different way. We don't know what is the right clustering most of the time. So we make our clustering, we live our life with our clustering, we get hit by the nature, and then if we have any brains, we change. If not, we just die. Okay? So that's the nice thing about unsupervised learning. Once in a while, we happen to have external validation, and you can connect it. Okay? You are making clusters all the time in your life. You have no clue whether those clusters are right. And you would not know right away. That's why it's unsupervised learning. Yes? It depends. Yeah, of course. I mean, the question, of course, is yes, indeed. I mean, there are multiple ways of grouping people. Multiple ways of grouping entities. Okay? And in fact, how you will get the multiple clusters is based on the distances. If I change the distance measure, I get a different. Change the distance measure, I'll get a different clustering. Okay? The stupid distance measure that we were using when we thought, you know, when we gave a different name for HIV is because we thought the features that matter in defining the distance measure have to have, you know, for example, the sexual orientation. Okay? Now, you made fun of me when I said a couple of times in the class that, you know, when I'm trying to, you know, classify you guys, can I take the length of your hair in deciding whether you get A grade or not? Right? Well, you won't know upfront whether or not it's a relevant feature. Okay, so you, in deciding distance measures, you have to know what are the relevant features.
Only women will get A and
women will get B. No, there are some men here. Except me and that guy, you know, we'll lose. But anyway, but the point being that, again, these are deep questions. You know, we all just make it into, you know, simplified calculations, but there are deep questions, you know, in unsupervised learning. Okay, how you define distance changes the clustering you find. How you define, I mean, the distance itself is defined in terms of the features. So how you define what are relevant features changes everything. Okay? Anyway, so in this case, so you have, once again, you know, the given that the external validation is given after you were done with your clustering, you have true negatives, false negatives, and then, you know, as I said, it's true positives, true negatives by the total. That would be my measure. And this does have the good property that putting everybody in their own cluster would not be good. Right? So it won't get a 1 for RAND index. Everybody in a different cluster. Okay. Then the other thing is that this connection to precision and recall, this is what we are saying. So if you're thinking with respect to this in terms of the precision and recall measures, you know, the true positives by true positives plus false positives is sort of, is this clustering putting the people, the entities that belong together or not? So the precision is concerned about, are your clusters sort of pure? Okay, and the recall is concerned about, are you missing? So are you taking a cluster of all reds and split into three small clusters of all reds? In which case, precision will say it's still fine because red guys don't have any non-red guys in the cluster. But the recall will say, hey, you missed some of the red guys who went into some other cluster. They should be in this cluster. So these, if you think in terms of precision and recall, then you can have a different way of defining this combined measure. In fact, you can also use precision and recall and the F measure based on the precision and recall as the quality of clustering. Okay, or weighted F measure based on the quality of precision and recall as the quality of clustering. Okay? So In this case, actually, for this particular example, so it turns out that the numbers here will be 20, 72, 24, 20. And so the RAND index would be 20 plus 72 by the whole thing, which is 0.68. Okay. In case you're wondering how did these magic numbers come, you know, here is one part of the thing and the rest you can do at home. So we can compute TP plus FP first, which is basically the total pairs in the same cluster. Okay. And so that would be essentially there are 6C2 cluster, 6C2 here, 5C2 here, and 6C2 here, 6C2 here, and 5C2 here. These are all the pairs who are already in the same cluster. Okay, so that would be 40 if you, you know, choose to, C2 being choose to. Okay, so choosing 2 out of 6, choosing 2 out of 6, and choosing 2 out of 5. If you add them up, you'll get 40. Okay, of these, of course, only some of them are actually true positives, because those not only are in the same cluster, but they're supposed to be in the same cluster. Okay, so this is an interesting thing. So here, of course, 5 choose 2 pairs are in this cluster and should be in this cluster. And similarly, 4 choose 2 pairs are in this cluster and should be in this cluster. And similarly, 3 choose 2 pairs are in this cluster and should be in this cluster. And these two red guys are making a little red country in the green country. And they are happy too. It's like little Italy, little China, little red guy here, okay? And they're happy too. So basically, two choose two pairs are in the same cluster and should be together. Okay, this one basically, that's the point I was making earlier, that the RAND index doesn't differentiate between you taking one red cluster and splitting into multiple red clusters. It's missing part of that, right? Okay, so in this case, that would be 5 choose 2, 4 choose 2, 3 choose 2, plus 2 choose 2. I didn't have to do it for these guys because here there were no pairs of any other color than the majority color. Okay, and so if I do this, then I'll get the TP equal to 20, then I'll know what FP is. Okay, and then similar way you can compute FN and TM. Okay. And then the bottom, of course, you know anyway, because there are 17 guys here and 17 choose two. That would be 136, I think. Okay? So that's how you compute the RAND index in this particular case. But the insight is more important. We are no longer talking about individuals. We are talking about, are we breaking pairs? Or are we keeping pairs together? Which is really what a clustering is all about. Yes? No, it will take care of it partly, right? Because the pair, broken pair would be seen as a broken pair. It will be seen as a false negative, and it will come in the... It does penalize, not as much as you would be able to do if the point about the precision recall is, in some applications, you might be having different costs, different penalties for splitting couples versus bringing couples who can't stand each other together. Here, you know, here you're assuming all errors are created equal. Here you can differentiate the error and say splitting couples might be a bigger problem than you know, keeping couples together or vice versa. If so, you can weight them. That's the whole point. Okay, but notice where we went. We went from just normal clustering, which is like, you know, looking for sort of patterns in the Rocha block test kind of a thing, into saying, is it a good clustering? And in trying to decide whether it's a good clustering or not, we talked about two different measures. One internal measure, which is, does it look clean? So for example, when you're done with your, you know, exam, you hopefully are making sure that the exam is good by your internal standards. You know, did I write things legibly? Do my answers look kind of interesting, right? and then the external evaluation, and most of the time that's all you have. I mean, as much as you hate classes, classes are good because after the end of each exam you get a grade. Life is bad because you make these decisions and you're only told most of the time after you're dead and gone that you're a loser or you're a winner. Okay, I mean, I keep thinking about this. Remember this guy, Alan Greenspan. How many of you know Alan Greenspan? This guy, this class doesn't seem to read papers. Alan Greenspan is, you know, Fed chairman, and he was seen as like the most, you know, amazingly talented economist of his time. He was seen as that all the way until 2008. If he croaked in 2008, I'm not saying he should, then he would have, you know, kind of gone away thinking the world thinks he is a big winner. Okay, 2008, the housing bubble. Now everybody says, Alan Greenspan, he's a loser. And then he had to go on our TV saying, oh my God, you know, what can I do? I did the best I could. Which is what he was doing all along. Do you see what I'm saying? And so the tests in life are not there after every exam. And so having exams is good. It's episodic. And you're done with this test and you're gone. Okay. Most of the time, the external evaluation comes after a sequence of clusterings you have made. And you are paying for the consequences of the sequence of decisions you have made. And sometimes you may not even realize it. You're gone and your family has to deal with it. Okay. But that's a different story. Okay. So, as I said, you know, clustering is considered unsupervised learning, but the bigger issue is, as I said, really, it's not fully unsupervised. You know, you can keep, you know, throwing in little bit of knowledge of, you know, how many clusters are there, for example, or that, okay, cluster these points. By the way, here are some friends. Please keep them together. This happens all the time when, you know, when administrators are putting, you know, high school kids into sections or middle school kids into sections. Parents come and say, you know, my kid and this other kid, they're friends, please put them in a class together. And then somebody else will say, that kid and my kid can't get along well, please put them in two far away classes, you know. And so the teacher who is kind of clustering them into sections has to take these must link and must not link constraints and still make a clustering. So there's extra information which will tell you what clusterings are better and what are worse. Okay? So those kinds of information, teacher tells you that certain pairs of points will fall or will not fall in the same cluster. That's must link and must not link. And if you, you know, the more you satisfy them, the better your clustering is. So if you have these kinds of knowledge, then it becomes less of a pure unsupervised activity and more of a something in between supervised and unsupervised activity. Okay. But if people still tend to think of clustering as the poster child for unsupervised learning and classification as the poster child for supervised learning. Okay. How hard is clustering? We did this already. If you have K clusters, if I tell you that they are K hard clusters, they are K power n by K factorial clusterings. Okay. And basically because each point can go into any of the clusters. So each point has n possibilities. Okay? I'm sorry, each point has k possibilities. There are n such points, k times k times k times k, n times, so k power n. Now the order doesn't matter. So you divide by k factorial. Okay? And then you don't know how many clusterings are there, so you really have to consider k equal to 1 to n. And that's the number of clusterings you have. And then one idea for clusterings is basically generate each one of these clusterings, you know, use something which is cluster size insensitive, such as RAND index, okay, to compare which clustering is better, or find the clustering which is the optimal. And you're done. Okay, now the problem, of course, is this is a huge number. You should try with some reasonable values of k and see how k and n. To see how bad it can, well, not k and n, I mean just n, because it's only dependent on n. See how bad the number can get. Okay, and so you're not going to be, even if you're spending like a polynomial time for checking the quality of the clustering, you're going to take a long, long time just computing the best clustering. So in essence, you need to, what we'll wind up doing is, it's most of the time it's too hard to do it brute force and get an optimal solution. So what you do is iterative optimization algorithms or greedy searches, where you greedily construct iterative idea is you construct a clustering, look around, see if it can be improved, one more clustering, look around, see if it can be improved, one more clustering, and then stop after one. That's iterative. Now, iterative algorithms are like hill climbing algorithms, for example, if you have heard about them before. But in general, they are not guaranteed to find optimal anything. But they run fast. Okay? And the poster child of iterative approach for clustering is K-means, which is a very nice algorithm. Some of you probably already know it. And you know, if you haven't, then it's a cute algorithm to know. So you will essentially start with the clustering and iteratively improve it. In particular, so we will look at a bunch of methods for clustering, starting with K-means today. The first one is K-means, as I said, we'll talk about that, where you assume that the number of clusters is given and you're trying to find out a clustering that has that many number of clusters. Okay. The next one is the hierarchical methods, where in essence you sort of construct a hierarchy of clusters. So you start with all the elements and maybe first split them into two clusters. And then take each of the clusters and split them again. Each of the clusters and split them into two again. That way you'll get a hierarchy of clusters. So in a way, that is sort of like, well, all American for a cluster if you are comparing it to some other country. But then within US, there are clusters. There are Arizonans, there is Tennesseans, and there are various other things. So it's more of a hierarchical clustering there. Okay, and the hierarchical clustering can be done in a dissecting way. That means start with all and split it into two, and each of them split again into two. That's called, that's a divisive hierarchical methods. Or you can do agglomerative way, where you start bottom up and construct hierarchy. Now, whenever you're doing it, the main thing in clustering is what? Distance. Okay? So we'll be looking at Euclidean distance in the examples today, but when you use it on text documents, you will be using vector similarity or Jaccard similarity. Okay? What did I do? Okay. So, K-means. So it works when you know K, which is the number of clusters we are supposed to find, and it will find you exactly those number of clusters. Okay, and what it will try to do is give a weak guarantee that among all clusterings of this data into K clusters, the one I'm giving is kind of going to be good. Unfortunately, it won't say it is optimal because we'll see that it won't be optimal, but it will try to make it better by essentially improving the clustering iteratively until it reaches a plateau and it cannot improve any further. Okay? So the idea for K-means is much simpler. It's worth looking at it in an animation. But I tend to think of it as if in a grade school, right? If the teacher says, okay, form yourself into three groups, right? You form yourself into three groups. If I tell you right now, form yourself into three groups, you'll form yourself into three groups. Okay? Many a time, one way of visualizing that process is three different kids sort of have this, pseudo-leader tendencies and say, okay, I am a group. And this other kid says, I'm a separate group. And then you look at these three guys and say, whichever is looking good, you go join that group. Okay? And then after you join the group, then you look around and say, all your friends are in that other group. And then those guys say all their friends are in this group. So there's the amount of change for a while. Okay? Until things start off crystallize. And furthermore, notice that, interestingly, the three kids who started by saying we are the pseudo leaders of these groups, in the end may not actually be the pseudo leaders of their group at all. Because by the end, all their enemies might be in their group. And so they will actually become majority and this guy is still stuck there. In fact, if the leader doesn't have too many principles, the leader might themselves shift over to a different cluster. Right? That's what happens in K-means, essentially. Okay, so this is like iterative way in which you look around and see, is there a better place I can go to? Now, the interesting thing, of course, is all these decisions are done independently. Every individual makes an independent decision. Okay? That's why it runs fast, but that also is why it cannot be optimal. really the way to do it is basically while the teacher is about to say you go split yourself into three groups, then you whip out your cell phones and start coordinating and say, all of us, the red guys, let's go to this corner. And then you just stand there. Okay, so you coordinate it with everybody in your group. That will lead to much better clustering. Okay, in particular, if sets of elements are allowed to simultaneously shift from one group to another group, okay, then it's going to be better, then it actually can be optimal. But that would be a lot more work than individuals making the decisions. Okay, yes.
There are some cases that I guess it would have to randomly pick, because if you give a uniform distribution, then it won't.
No, it basically, if there is a measure it looks at, and then when the measure doesn't change between two iterations or doesn't change by more than an epsilon, it just stops. It's the same thing like page rank, basically, iterative computation. Page rank is another iterative computation, right? So here's a nice animation actually from Ray Mooney. Here is your old graph, right? That's the one you're looking at. And then I'll just pick, for the heck of it, these two guys become the pseudo leaders. This guy is the red group, this guy is the blue group. Now it almost looks like those are such bad seeds, you can see, you see what they don't see, which is you see that this is a cluster, that's a cluster. The real question is whether eventually individual decisions will work out to find this clustering. In this case actually it will, okay. So you have red and blue, and then every point computes its distance to the centroid of the red cluster and the centroid of the blue cluster. And whichever it is closer to, it just goes and joins that cluster. Okay, for simplicity, we'll assume that these things are done iteratively. That means when all of them compute, once the leaders are announced, all of you then compute your distance to the red cluster centroid, green, blue cluster centroid. At this time, of course, notice that in the very beginning, the red cluster is just the red guy, the one guy, and the blue cluster is just one blue guy. Okay, as more and more elements come in, you actually have to compute the centroid. And right now the centroid is the only element, okay? So all of you are computing your distance to both red guy and blue guy, all these points, and then we'll just shift into the one that is closer to them, and breaking ties randomly, okay? Right? So in this case, what happens? All these guys will be closer to red, and so they go to red, and these guys are closer to blue, so they go to blue. Now notice that if you do this, this was actually more like the way the page rank matrix goes from zeroth iteration to one iteration. The page rank vector goes from zeroth iteration to first iteration to second iteration. That's how I'm saying it here. But I also said in page rank that it's actually better sometimes to do it in place. That means, you let one of the values change and the rest of the guys, the next guy will look at the changed values in deciding their values. So that can be done here too, and in fact that is a much better idea for k-means. What that means is, suppose in the first iteration this guy becomes part of the red. Now the centroid of the red is here. So then the next guy who is going to decide can look at that centroid in deciding whether to join the red group or the blue group. So even as you are trying to decide which group to join, you already see your enemies are joining that group, so you will start joining this group. That's what it is. Okay? Classical k-means assumes that you're doing it one iteration after another. But you can easily improve. This is like a simple improvement, and which is significant in practice. Okay? Fine. So in this case, after one iteration, these are all red, these are all blue. Basically it doesn't, at this, and the way this stops is if nobody changes clusters, then you stop. That's all. That's a reasonable thing. If nobody is changing clusters now, they're not going to change clusters tomorrow. Okay? So at this point, now what happened is the red is such that the centroid for red is somewhere here. And the blue is such that the centroid for blue is sort of somewhere here. Now, given these new centroids, then everybody can again independently, including the leader. In this case, actually, the original red and blue don't have to stick to the red and blue. Each of them will just, you know, make a decision and join the new join the cluster that's closest to them. Okay? If you were to do that, so in this particular case, the red centroid is here, and the blue centroid is here. So now everybody looks at these two centroids and then decides. Everybody, including the leaders, including the old-time leaders, look at these centroids and decide, you know, which cluster they're going to join. Okay. So then, of course, at this point, once you do this, then everybody, when they make up these decisions, because by this time, what happens is all these guys would realize that they're closer to this than to this. And these guys anyway realize they're closer to this. Okay? So what happens is, in the next iteration, those red guys become blue, and these guys just stick around. That's it. You're done. At this point, actually, you're not yet done. So what you'll wind up doing is you recompute the centroids. Okay? The centroid for red is here, centroid for blue is here now. Now you ask everybody, do you want to change? At this time, nobody wants to change. And so you stop. Okay? Looks like the coolest, cheapest algorithm that you can do. And so everybody, when they have to write a clustering algorithm, the first thing they'll do is k-means clustering. Okay? So what you'll try to do in the remaining time today and also next class, that is next Thursday, what are the properties of k-means clustering? Okay? Anyway, so in this case, it's converged. So what k-means is optimizing, essentially, it turns out, remember, it's a clustering algorithm. The only thing that you can try to optimize over is the internal measure. There is no point in optimizing to external measure, because as I said, if you happen to know the answers to the exam, don't write something and check. Just write, copy the answer. That's much more efficient. Right? So the point is, if you are making the clusters and you want to see is this clustering any better than the next clustering, you need to only consider internal measures of consistency of the clusters. And there are two ideas, right? One is intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance. Since I have kept k constant, then I would argue that in some sense, the intra-cluster tightness, if you maximize that, if you maximize the tightness, you also, by definition, maximize the inter-cluster distance. Because the k is constant. I'm keeping this k the same. So if each cluster becomes closer and closer to itself, then it's also, by definition, becoming farther and farther from everybody else. Okay? So even though the function is supposed to be a function of both inter-cluster tightness, intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance, actually, you can think of k-means as just focusing on the intra-cluster tightness. Now, how do you define the intra-cluster tightness? What all you can do is, you basically can consider the distance between every point in the cluster to its centroid of the cluster. Okay, suppose I have these points. Remember, centroid in k-means doesn't even have to be a real point. Right? And so, essentially, you have computed the centroid and you are asking yourself, how close are you to the centroid? So, you are, let's say, this is d1, this is d2, this is d3, and so on. Okay? You take the distances, essentially, you sum those distances. Sum of squares of distances. Okay? Notice that since this is one cluster, here the distances for the points are with respect to this cluster. The guys here will be looking at their distances from their own centroid. And I take all the distances here, sum of squares of these distances, sum of squares of these distances, and sum them all together. That will give me, a measure of tightness of the clusters. of the K clusters. And you can see that K means when it goes from iteration to iteration to iteration, it is not, it is guaranteed to not increase this distance. It's guaranteed to not increase this distance, which is, you know, you're computing the tightness as a sum of distances of elements within each cluster to its centroid. Right? As the whole point of the iterations in K-means is for you to go closer to your centroid. Go into a cluster where you are closer to the centroid. Right? And that's basically, you can see that, in fact, if you actually compute, you know, this measure from iteration to iteration to iteration, you can see that it's monotonically non-increasing. It's most of the time actually reducing. Okay? And then when it reaches a minimum point, when it no longer, nobody has any incentive to change, okay? And that minimum may not be the global minimum, it turns out. There may be a different clustering over the same K cluster that might be even smaller, but K-means won't have, you know, K-means with the initial seeds may not have come to that because it's an iterative process, okay? So the reassignment monotonically decreases G since each vector is assigned to the closest centroid, okay? Now, other interesting thing is, if you are focusing on considering tightness by reducing, making the sum of squares to the centroid be minimum, what shape do you think will you get? Spheres. High-dimensional spheres. What if the clusters that naturally define your data are not actually spherical? You will still find them. Because if it's spheres you're going to look for, you're going to find spheres. Okay? So that's the problem with any clustering method. They have their own inbuilt bias in finding particular shaped clusters. K-means tries to find spherical clusters. And if you have a bunch of data which is sort of chain data, then K-means is not a particularly good, particularly good at doing it in that case. Okay. One last thing, of course, is the value that K-means comes to. As I said, this value, this measure keeps monotonically non-decreasing. At some point of time, it stops changing from two iterations. Between two iterations, if it doesn't change, then you just stop at that point. That means it didn't change because nobody wanted to move. Right? At this point, can I say that it is an optimal such clustering? I mean, is this the lowest this number could have come across all the K clusterings of this data? Across all the K clusterings of this data. Okay? And the answer is no. And the reality, the reason, and I'll give you an example first, because I'll come back to these things later. But look at, let's see, I think look at this example. Okay? The problem with K-means is the initial seeds wind up changing the cluster you will eventually get to. Okay? So if I have points like this, okay, and if I start with B and E as the initial centers, okay, then I would find A, B, C, and D, E, F as the clusters. As much as in that example, we found that the initial leaders didn't matter, actually they do in some pathological cases, which is why K-means is not optimal. Okay, which is one reason why K-means is not optimal. So if you had picked B and E, you would got A, B, C, and D, E, F as the clusters. Whereas if you picked D and F, okay, then you would get A, B, D, E, and C, F as the clusters. And these two clusterings may not have the same cluster tightness. In fact, one can argue, I would say that this clustering is tighter. These four together, these two together is tighter clustering than those three together. But if you started with B and E as the initial seeds, in some sense, K-means would never have found this clustering. Now the question is, why would that happen? And the reason for that is really because individuals are changing one at a time. If individuals can coordinate and change in groups, this problem won't happen. Okay, but you know, from a theoretical point of view, K-means is not optimal even for the measure it's trying to optimize. But it is a pretty good algorithm in general. Okay, the last picture I will show is this. This is on some real data on something, antenna data. It's about some measurements on antennas, okay, over to X and Y axis. And here is the way the data is shown. And if I ask it to find three clusters in it, irrespective of where it starts, it will, you know, eventually find the three correct clusters. In this, I mean, not irrespective, I'm sorry. In this case, actually, you're showing, I started with this, and I'm assuming these are the, let's see, how many clusters are we looking at? Two-dimensional parts are located in the clusters. Okay, the circles are the means, and so we actually are looking for two clusters in this case. Okay, so suppose I assume that these are the two centers originally, and then after one iteration, then this becomes one cluster, this becomes another cluster, and so the centers will change again. Okay, and the centers will change until this is one cluster and this is another cluster, which is sort of what you have seen, you know, by looking at the picture. Okay, and this plot actually shows how the wrongly placed centroids slowly traverse to their correct place. Okay, generally K-means clustering is pretty good, and if you're doing it for text data, and if you are sort of thinking, okay, I have 1,000 documents that I'm about to give as the answers to the user. Can I then try to look for five clusters in it? You will find five clusters. And then you can show the user each of the five clusters. That actually raises a question as to how do you provide a snippet for the cluster, which we'll talk about a little next class. Okay? But then if I give you a little snippet on all the each of the clusters, then you will be able to you are actually able to give the user the ability to decide which cluster they are more interested in. And then that sort of increases the precision. Okay? I'll stop here. We'll come back and continue this next Thursday.